microphones and make a podcast. Two microphones and you make a podcast.
Hi, this is Joyce.
And this is Mary Beth.
Welcome to the Modern Yoga Podcast. We have a very special guest today. Her name is Amber Voorhees, and she is a yoga student at Modern Yoga. You've been practicing for quite a while, way before COVID, right?
Yeah, I think pretty close to when you opened.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'll check that in a moment.
Are you related to the most famous Voorhees of ever?
I am so impressed that you know that reference. Yes, I'll tell you that we, growing up, we would get prank phone calls every Friday the 13th asking if Jason was home, and we'd always say, oh, I'm sorry, he's off at camp.
Oh, excellent answer. So yes. Come on, if everybody's not on board, it's clearly a relative of Jason Voorhees of Camp Crystal Lake fame, Friday the 13th.
Oh, I didn't know.
They were making love while he was drowning. I'm sorry. I digress.
I didn't know that Jason's last name was Voorhees.
Yes.
I mean, you should, Joyce. That was a miss.
Probably if you were in school these days, nobody would probably know except for the rare. I don't know.
Yeah, that was, you know, a lot for the time. There wasn't the big CGI, crazy graphic-y stuff. So those murders were scary.
Yeah. Gruesome.
I told you we digress.
But back to Amber.
Amber, so I looked it up. Thursday, November 17th, 2016, you came to a Hot Power Basics class.
Year one.
So yeah, year one. Yeah, yeah, about what's May to November, about 6 months or so in. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Thank you for continuing to practice and being part of the community.
Oh, absolutely.
Why did you first come to yoga, and how do you feel like it impacts you?
Well, I found Modern Yoga because it was located between my job and my home. So at the time I was the executive director of an assisted living in Strongsville. And I desperately needed to do some self-care.
Well, kudos to you, because I bet there's like a Dairy Queen in between your home and your job, too.
I think the DQ is right across the street from your
right?
old
it
job,
is.
Right?
It yeah. And the truth is, I have practiced yoga on and off since college. But at the time, like I said, I just had a very stressful job and I needed to do something for myself. And I've been going, you know, pretty religiously ever since. And it really is a huge part of my just taking care of myself, and my physical and mental health depend on yoga. And I'm a walker.
Are you?
Yeah.
So is Mary Beth.
Yeah.
I am too. I just have senior dogs right now and we don't walk very far, but that's okay.
I walked yesterday in Brecksville before my class. I always say, let's walk about it. Instead of let's talk about it, let's walk about it.
I'm going to digress for a moment. Mel, one of our teachers, we had a meeting a couple of months ago and she's like, do you just want to meet at the park and walk? And I was like, that would be amazing. And not only was it really nice, it was a very productive conversation.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends that have started doing that and it's a great idea. We
it
don't
really
spend
is.
Any money. We don't drink any alcohol or eat any carbs. And you know, you get that rare opportunity to enjoy some nature, some squirrels and stuff you don't see every day. Step in some goose shit. It's called connecting with Mother Earth.
But Amber, you have a young one too, right?
Yeah, my daughter's 13.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Jeez. Okay. So
she was quite young when I started at Modern
right.
Yoga.
And I think
yeah.
I've only met her
yeah,
or seen
now,
her
right?
so, once or
yeah.
twice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a first grader at the time, probably. And now,
yes. Yeah.
What now she's on the verge of probably being hellish.
Well, she's starting eighth grade next week. So
that's say no more.
Crazy. Yeah. She's a good kid.
You're going to need more yoga.
Right. That's entirely possible.
Okay, though. It's like, that's when we all get a little, you're not supposed to be like an adult when you're 13.
Yeah, no, there's a lot happening cognitively, right? A lot of lot of neurons misfiring.
Yeah, which is part of what we're having you here to talk about, which is great. Yeah. Great segue.
I met James when Ashley was 11, and he describes it as the very end of her very, very sweet era. And then within about, you know, the next 6 to 12 months, we went into the preteen.
Fight or flight.
Yeah, constant. But it's all good.
The important thing, a little detail to remember, is that when push came to shove, literally, because childbirth was part of it, that little baby whose birthday is almost here, your granddaughter, is named Alina what?
Joyce.
Alina Joyce. Maybe that was Ashley's way of smoothing over the teenage years.
I think, well, I don't know if that was the specific intent, but
but it works, right?
Apparently, well, I don't know if everybody knew, but James knew that was her middle name. She had told us she was naming her Alina, but the middle name was kind of up in the air to me. And then she was born and she sent me a photo of her birth certificate. And I was
and that's how you told me. You just sent a photo of her birth certificate and I sobbed. I was like, oh my gosh, her middle name's Joyce.
So sweet.
So, which brings us to 2020. I was just talking about, we were talking about 2020 and teacher training the other day. And I think it was like last week or something. It just really hit me. Not that I haven't thought about 2020, but you know, Ashley told us she was pregnant at the beginning of the year. We moved her home. We took her out of the University of Akron, switched her to Tri-C. The pandemic hit. My dad went into the hospital for the first time in July, and then he went in again in August twice. The second time he never came out. My dad, or Alina, was born in August, August 27th, and then my dad died in October. So,
I like,
right. And Amber, actually, I talked to you quite a bit. Well, we couldn't get close in 2020, but you helped me navigate some things in 2020 because my dad was going into a rehab, and then there was a possibility of him going into assisted care, and it never got to that point because he passed. But I knew then, and I know now how difficult that was for me. I can't imagine how difficult your job is beyond like the job, but the emotional impact. I guess that's part of the job that, like, I don't know how you keep your head straight, you know?
So you talked first about running the assisted living.
Yeah.
Tell us what you do now as well, or the progression of your profession.
So I ran the assisted living for about 4 years. And then I just was really struggling with work life balance. You know, as we mentioned, my daughter was still quite young. So I approached the owners of the company, who I have worked for many years, even before I was running the assisted living, I worked for them. And I said, hey, I can't do this forever. And they're just good people. And they said, okay, you know, hang in there. Let's see what else we can come up with. And really, within 3 months, they approached me and said the hospice that they own and operate, which is called Cypress Hospice, it's out of Berea. They were looking for community relations, you know, somebody to build relationships, to provide education, to talk to families, to talk to seniors. And it just seemed like a really good fit for me. So I have now been with Cypress for 4 years.
How nice to be able to be confident enough in your job and your skills to go to your owners and say, this is how I'm feeling. Not worried that they're now going to fire you or that they're going to punish you, but, and for them to respond with, hang in there, let's see what we can do with this.
Yeah. I'd like to say that all of healthcare is like that, but that would not be true at all. I'm very fortunate. I've worked for the family for almost 14 years, 13 years. Yeah. And again, they're good people. Yeah, so I'm very grateful. So now I work for Cypress, and it's really my job to have relationships with the local assisted livings, the local skilled facilities, the senior centers, the just in general, talking to people. I talk to a lot of families about hospice. You know, a nurse in an assisted living may give somebody my card and say, call Amber. And just start the conversation. What is hospice? What is end of life care? And I will say this, I work in geriatrics. You know, we specialize in older adults. We don't work with younger people. So I can't even imagine what that would be like to work with someone end of life who's young.
Right. That's a different story. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally different story. But
your job and your position is so valued because, like, I remember when my dad first needed care, it all happened kind of fast for us. I mean, the illness happened slowly. He had dementia, but eventually an incident happened. He went to a geriatric psych ward at the hospital and then went to a nursing home and then never came home again. And then a couple of years later, when it was time for hospice, you know, the medical professionals are so busy and so overworked, and there's not enough of them. And a lot of this process is rote to them. So they don't maybe warn you or prepare you for what these next steps are. So I love that, you know, basically it sounds like that's what your position is about.
Yes. And you're so right. We, you know, healthcare, everybody is overwhelmed, even more so now after the pandemic. And, you know, the other piece of it is that we live in a youth obsessed culture, and our medical professionals are taught to cure, right? Mm-hmm. It's such a shift to say, okay, we're not going to focus on curative. We're going to talk about making somebody comfortable so that they can enjoy their last period of time on this earth. Right. It's just a huge shift. And even, you know, doctors, I think, are ill-prepared to even have those conversations.
Absolutely. You see and hear so many. I mean, we all have friends with let's even just say parents. Forget about the younger people passing from diseases that these poor people are clearly not going to make it, and doctors are valiantly trying. And I understand your family even might be pressuring you to keep fighting, keep trying. It's wonderful to know that there's an option, you know, out there to healthfully say, let go of this fight and enjoy our time together. We can say goodbye and feel a little better about it.
Do you feel like people generally avoid talking about this until they have no choice?
Absolutely. You know, we're again, youth obsessed, right? Yeah. And I mean, it's such a shame that people used to die in their homes. We used to have funerals in our homes, right? Now we've medicalized everything. People die in the hospital, connected to tubes and buttons, and, you know, yes, we do not live in a culture where we talk about death, plan for it. We're not open about it. And here's the thing, you know, we're all going to die.
Right.
It's part of this experience that we're having on this earth.
So everybody wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to go now. Right. And you just don't want to let go. So you do cling to that. If, you know, if you don't die today, you might not die tomorrow if we try this, you know, without thinking of, well, this isn't fun today or tomorrow. This, you know, as you said, hooked up. Of all people, when I was walking yesterday, Guy Fieri was on Brooke Shields' podcast called Now What? And he was talking about his sister who passed away from cancer young, but they made the decision. It was a recurrence of cancer. She made the decision to not do chemotherapy. And he was talking about at length how special and wonderful that was. And then in her case, because of her beliefs in life. They had looked into and found a green burial. So they did what you were just saying, Amber. All her friends came and shrouded her in flowers. And they, and you know, she, after she had passed, she was in her own home. All the friends came. And then I'm not quite sure what they do with the green burial. He didn't really explain that. But to have this, like, you know, bleach haired, motorcycle riding chef guy full of tattoos talk about how lovely hospice is and these other options versus the clinical way that most of us are used to dying and having a funeral was really refreshing.
I mean, it's so beautiful, right? That she got to choose how to, you know, end the time on this earth. There's actually, I don't know if you've ever heard of, there's something called a death doula. You've all heard of doulas,
yes,
right? Who help at birth. So it's really just coming to this area, but you know, like California, I think has probably the largest number, sure, of death doulas.
And doesn't that make perfect sense now to hear you say that term out loud? Duh.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're usually nurses who just want to dedicate their time and energy to helping somebody die with dignity and to transition out of this life the way that they're meant to. It's really pretty cool. So yeah, Google it, death doula.
Yeah, I sure will. I guess I wish, and nobody's has a crystal ball, even doctors, and miracles happen all the time. But you kind of wish the conversation might come a little more easily for medical professionals treating people to say, this isn't going anywhere except pain and expense. And, you know, but I don't think that happens enough.
Well, I was going to ask, just on the flip side, I know that there are doctors who specifically work in geriatrics, but really any doctor can face dying patients. And are they prepared for it?
Yeah, maybe they need a death doula, the doctors.
Yeah. You know, I think it is definitely glossed over in medical school. I really don't think that there is enough training.
Because they do study medicine.
Yes. Right. Their objective is to cure.
I'm supposed to medicate this problem. I'm supposed to surgically fix this problem.
Yeah. But, you know, even in my training, so I have a master's degree in social work. I only had one class in death and dying.
Wow.
And it was awesome. And I'm so glad that I took the class. And I will say it was not my focus. It was nothing that I was interested in. But, you know, to your point, I think culturally, in any medical field, we need to have more education and communication and talk about death and dying.
Scary though, we don't want to let go. I'm in a happy, good mood today. I don't want to think about losing somebody.
Push your cord in, Mary Beth.
My cord is that better?
No, it's okay though. I don't want to digress too much for technical problems. So you're now working less in assisted living and, you know, in a facility, a hospice facility, and more with the public, right? I mean, I think we all know what hospice is, but how do you describe hospice?
Oh, good question. So I will tell you this, Medicare's guideline is that somebody with the normal progression of their disease would have 6 months or less to live. So that's how somebody qualifies. Now, with that said, somebody may qualify and be on hospice for a year and a half,
mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't mean that they will die in 6 months, but that's sort of the guideline that they, okay, somebody has a terminal disease, they've opted not to do aggressive treatment, and with the normal progression, they would have 6 months or less to live. And the services that hospice provides are nurses, nurse's aides to come in and help with bathing, dressing, grooming, polish someone's nails. We have chaplains to provide spiritual care. We have social workers. We even have volunteers who will just come in and sit and read, or, you know, take somebody outside. So it's really all hands on deck, providing physical and emotional spiritual care, both to the patient and their families.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, everybody has, almost everybody I know has, if they have a hospice story, it's a wonderful one. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's helpful is often we feel guilty when our loved one's in the hospital because they're gross and there's tubes and there's blood and not everybody's unsqueamish about that stuff. So just the loving care of coming in and seeing your dad, smelling shaving cream, he was just shaved, his hair's combed, whether he's conscious or unconscious, it enables you to get closer, which is important because then you've got the guilt on top of everything else.
Absolutely. And, you know, our team, because we're more comfortable with this phase of life, we can ask the questions that we might say to a patient, you know, how are you processing, or, you know, inquire about their spiritual beliefs, where family might want to do that, but is uncomfortable to do that. Mm-hmm. It's really powerful to have a team come in and to be comfortable with what's happening and normalize things.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Normalize. We were in hospice with my dad for over 2 weeks and we laughed, we cried, we did what we called hospice shopping online.
So it was a very big time in the family. And then those nurses are amazing at figuring out, like, I remember the first week, our hostess, Paula, who I'm Facebook friends with, of course, now,
said, you know, she didn't work the weekend. She said, I'll see you Monday. The following Friday, she said, last week, I said, I'd see you Monday. I'm not sure I'm going to see you Monday. So it was
preparing us the
could. And she was right on. I think my dad died Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. It might have been the Monday, but I think it was the Tuesday.
Amber, I was going to ask before if working more with the public and less with families and patients, like in hospice, was less stressful for you. But you mentioned that, like, you, your teams, people who work in hospice are obviously a little bit more comfortable with death. Is that training or experience, or like, how do you get there? Do you know what I mean? That seems like a huge leap.
Yes. I think, you know, we always say it really is a calling. You know, I think there are people who are called to work with people who have dementia. You know, that takes an incredible amount of patience. Yeah. And I think there are people who are called to work at end of life. Yes, of course, we provide training, but sometimes we train someone and it's pretty clear it's not a good fit, right?
Yeah,
it's we call it the hospice heart. Some people are meant to do it, and some people aren't. And I know, you know, when I say I work in hospice, everybody thinks, oh God, you know, it's so depressing. But I'll tell you, the people that I work with, you know, if you came to our office, you would hear laughter and camaraderie. And I work with kind, compassionate people, and people who really understand that life is short and precious. And just, you know, sort of live according to that idea that, hey, this time here is short. Let's make it the best it can be. Yeah. So it sounds terrible, but it's really quite wonderful.
is mental health care part of either what is offered to hospice workers, or is it something that you recommend? Like, I know that it's way more normal to you than it is to me, but it's still a lot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all of our jobs are still a lot. I think yours can take it to its own level, but what is recommended for mental health?
Well, we do maybe once a year have, I forget what we call it. It might be like a memorial service, a time when the whole team gets together and kind of processes things. And we'll talk about, you know, the nurses will talk about their favorite patients or just kind of process things. You know, next week we're having a staff picnic. And that's not necessarily to address grief and loss, but it's really just to give everyone an opportunity to see each other and to laugh and, and to build team. And then I think the other piece of it is just, of course, encouraging people to have self-care, to, you know, whatever, practice yoga or walk or have their own counselor.
Yeah.
But that's, I think that should be a part of healthcare in general. If you work in healthcare, you have got to do some kind of self-care. And notoriously, people in healthcare do not, right? They're busy taking care of other people. They always say nurses are the absolute worst patients. I think that's entirely true because they're too busy taking care of everybody else.
Right. And then they resort to just stress measures, you know, like poor eating and not having time to exercise, or you'll see the nurses outside smoking together.
Smoking. Like, oh my gosh. Yes. It's so crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. I, when I see young people smoking, I'm like, it just blows my mind. You know, I guess I have a little bit more understanding for someone in our age range because we're not that old, but
it was bad when we were kids. Cause I remember always trying to get my dad to quit, but the generation before, I mean, our mom's generation, they smoked when they were pregnant.
Right.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, once upon a time there were ashtrays at nurses' stations.
Oh, wow.
I believe it. Yeah.
And I can't remember cause I didn't fly much as a kid, but
airplane.
Like I can't stand to be on the airplane now. I can't imagine it with that cloud of smoke.
Yeah, smoking is such a weird thing. When people are in hospice, it's never really a sudden thing, is it? How are the patients? We're talking a lot about families and caregivers. How are the patients like all of a sudden we're moving to hospice?
Yeah. Well, again, I work in geriatrics, so I can tell you, much of my experience is that older adults will say, I've lived a good life. I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, and more often than not, it's the family who's saying, Mom, you know, keep pushing. I'm not ready to say goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not 100%, but it's pretty common.
And at least they're, you know, some people are getting to an age just in numbers where they're like, mm-hmm. It's time. I mean, I'm, you know, let's say I'm 88. How much longer? I'm not probably going to be 108. So we're getting there.
Yeah. And of course that's not 100%. But it is a large part of who we serve. Gosh, if I had a dollar for every time an elderly person said to me, honey, don't get old, I'd be rich.
You're not gonna like it.
I don't know how you do that. How old is the oldest patient you've ever had?
Well, she's not a patient of ours because she's not ready for hospice, but at one of the facilities that I do a lot with, there's a resident who's 108.
Oh my gosh. It's so funny. I just said 108 as a joke.
Right.
Yeah, no, she's 108. And I ask her, you know, okay, what's the secret? And she said, honey, just keep moving.
We hear that all the time, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And usually by that age, we start to hear our elderly say, I hope I don't live that long. I don't want to live that long, you know?
Yeah.
But there's probably a difference. I mean, there has to be a difference between somebody who is relatively healthy and mobile versus somebody who's on, you know, 20 medications like my dad was, and mobility is an issue. Like nobody wants to be like that, but like if your head's pretty clear and your body's working, then I can't imagine it, you know, you'd want to go, right?
Like I can tell you from working with the elderly for many, many years that, you know, I have seen 70-year-olds who are at death's door. They look like they're 100. And I've seen 100-year-olds who are still moving and active and they look like they're 70. So yes, 100%. It's all relative to to health and
yeah, we shouldn't really think of the number.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, that's part of talking about yoga and walking and self-care. You know, I've always been active. And for a long time, that was vanity, right? Like, I just wanted to look good. Mm-hmm. But now it's really, in middle age, it's totally different. I want to be healthy and energetic. And, you know, I want to live.
So true. That is the big change at this age for me too, is I've always been dieting and everything for vanity. And now it's like, I don't even eat to lose weight. I eat because I'm losing muscle mass. That changes what I eat and how I exercise just to be able to be mobile and healthy and stuff. And it's like, wow, when did that happen?
Yes. Right.
I don't even want to be smaller. I don't give a shit about that anymore.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, how, I don't know what you learn, like we just change. That's all, you know, like this is where we're at in life. And, but yeah, it does seem like fitness is very vain early in life when it's easy to be
fitness belly into my pants.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And then you're worried about your arteries.
Yes. Yes.
And your genetics and yeah.
Well, I mean, what do you always say? Mary Beth, about genetics.
The genetics loads the gun and your behaviors can pull the trigger. That was a quote from Dr. Bill Frankel, a fella I used to know in the insurance business, in the wellness business.
Amber, how do you feel about the afterlife?
Oh,
whoa. Wow. Big question from Joyce.
Yeah. Holy moly. Well, yeah, go for it. I was raised a pretty conservative Christian, and it took me many years to be able to say out loud, I'm not Christian, and to feel comfortable, like the wrath of God wasn't going to, you know, strike me down.
Right.
So I'm not Christian. I do believe there's more than we could really process. I think our brains are small, and I feel very confident there's more than this, but I don't know what it is. And I don't believe that anybody on this earth really does. But I definitely have had experiences in my life that confirm this isn't it. So I know that's not a very concrete answer, but
it is though. I think like you just said, you're not Christian anymore. that's
I mean, big. Christian, any faith, I believe, allows for this giant, not understandable mystery. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, there can't be any boundaries to the belief, really, you know? And that's another thing of middle age, like getting in touch enough with yourself. You've seen enough of the work in your own life, mm-hmm. of something extra. But who or what that is or is called or what the rules are around it. Like I said, every religion allows for things that can't be explained. So even these rules and parameters, you have to acknowledge there can be flaw and mystery in it.
Yes.
I think that's our generation too, like kind of pushing back at our parents' generation of living by those rules and not sort of exploring maybe that the rules aren't always 100% fact, mm-hmm. or, you know, exactly what happens. I know, when my dad was dying, my mom insisted on having him get last rites by a Catholic priest. And my brothers and I, well, my one brother wasn't there yet, but my brother and I were like, what? You haven't even been to church in, not even on Christmas for years, you know, like,
just ingrained in her that mattered.
And like, I got it. It's like, okay, like that's not going to hurt anything. He can have less rights. But it was also like, they had to find a priest. We were at UH and I just assumed that there was a priest or a chaplain or somebody clergy on staff, but there was not. They have relationships with different congregations in the area. And so then it was this Catholic priest who we never met. It was just like this whole weird ceremonious kind
felt of like a little like a box to check to get in.
And then my mom,
your dad to have his ticket stamped.
Yeah, And then my mom, like, and I, you know, everybody is handles this stuff, I guess, maybe their own way, but you know, she was here and there asking my dad, like, if he was seeing his parents or his brothers, and she was looking for that, like, you know, and it was just, and again, it's how she dealt with it, and it made her feel better. But I, you know, thinking about that, even witnessing it, was like, what are you looking for here? You know, proof of the afterlife? Like, I don't know. Like,
which, as Amber just said, like, our brains cannot conceive and nobody can confirm. I mean, there are right. people who say they've been to the other side and been back. We don't know. And that's why we're afraid to talk about death, because we don't know what's next.
Yeah.
You believe what you believe, but.
I think in a lot of ways, just like we don't talk about death, and we also don't talk about, unless you're in a group who believes similarly to you, we don't really talk about afterlife or faith. Again, unless you're with the people that you practice
kind
with.
Of, right. You know, they're going to kind of agree with you and you all believe the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a shame, right? What amazing conversations we could be having.
Right. Well, then, and then you leave those, like, because we're not talking about it, you try to have those conversations on the deathbed.
Right.
And sometimes, I mean.
And nobody's at their best. Like, your families, listen, even the best of families, everybody, as you just said, Joyce, processes these things differently. So you're all in a different place. It's easy to argue and not play nice.
Yeah. I know in the case of my dad, like, he had so many problems and had them for so long that he had bypass surgery in 2001 and had a really rough recovery. He was diagnosed with peripheral artery disease not long before that. And there was, I'm not kidding you, it was probably the next 10 years. If my phone rang and my mom's name came up or the house phone came up, I, like, my heart, my stomach just dropped because, like, it just wasn't good. But my dad kept, like, I don't know if beating is the right word, but he kept, as his primary care physician. So I did a virtual a couple of times with my mom, with the primary care physician, because my mom needed that closure to talk, have him talk her through my dad's end of life, which he wasn't really part of. But my dad just wanted to be band-aided. He wanted to get their medication, take it, you know. He didn't really ever listen to any, he heard what he wanted to hear. He was also, you know, type 2 diabetic. He had lots of things going on. And if a doctor said, make sure to eat breakfast every day, he would find the cheapest, all you can eat breakfast and eat all he could eat, because that's essentially the instructions. Like, there wasn't a really true effort on making his lifestyle any better.
Yeah, the health versus the medicating. Like, my mom and her generation, I feel, are the same way. Like, I need the pill to sleep. I need a pill for weight loss. I need a pill to stop this pain in my shoulder.
Yeah, my mom told me the other day that her back has been hurting. And I said, like, how, where, you know, because I can help her a little bit. And she's like, well, I'm going to the doctor next week. And it's like, okay. So anyhow, my dad had, you know, been beating things for so long. When this process started with him going to the hospital a couple of times over the summer, it was a big deal, but it wasn't surprising.
You didn't think it was the end of his life.
Absolutely not. And we thought, even going into his final surgery, that he was going to end up with just his quality of life was going to be diminished even more than it was, but he was going to get through this as well. It was going to be more to manage. It was just kind of going to be along the lines of what my dad had been doing for the last 20 years. And so his death was very, almost shocking to, but it wasn't because, you know, 20 years ago, it was like, oh my God, this is killing him. But it's just really weird. And I feel like, you know, looking back, all the signs were there. But they just, the pieces weren't, the logic wasn't put together for one reason or another. Like my dad had been dying for at least a year, if not before, more than that. But here we were, like at the very end, being told he wasn't, you know, we were going to see him in cardiac, or in that cardiac, but in ICU, and a vent was coming out, and all of that. Like that was it. We didn't, and I don't, that was it. We were very, very lucky that he came out of the anesthesia he was under, because he didn't, they gave him like four doses of, or three doses of Narcan, and he wasn't responding at all. And they were like, nobody doesn't respond to this. So like, there's no point in even doing this again. And that was probably at somewhere between 9 and 10 PM. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, he started shaking his head. Yes and no. Cause we kept talking to him, because because everybody says, or everybody, I've heard a lot, we've heard a lot that they can hear, that hearing is one of the last things to go.
Yes.
So we kept talking to him, and at one point he started shaking his head, yes or no or whatever. And it was like, Dad, can you hear us? And he said, yeah. And I was like, did you hear last rites? And he's like, yeah. So he might have heard most of what was going on the whole time. We don't know, cause he couldn't talk. Right.
Just couldn't maybe move or awaken.
So we were,
which just goes to show you, as much as we know, we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. So we were lucky to have those last 6 to 8 hours with him, with a little bit of communication. But, you know, when you have a, like that, we could have some of the sort of end of life conversations with him, but not fully. He couldn't talk. Anything he could answer yes and no to, we could ask him.
And you got up even that day and brushed your teeth, not knowing this was the final goodbye. So you're not even prepared to have a conversation, because you're like, wait, what?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And, but yeah, like talking, I don't even know that he would have talked about death other than like, well, when I die, I want to be buried in the, apparently I didn't know this either. He wanted to be buried at Rittman, at the military cemetery. And you know, my mom, I at some point had said, do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be, you know, a traditional burial? And he was like, what do I care? I'll be dead, you know? And that was about the most substance we could get out of my dad.
Well said, Andy.
Death. Right.
And, like, you know, that's generational too, right? Yeah. That baby boomers are much less, I think, likely to have those conversations than, you know, other generations, hopefully. You know, and I also think you're talking about your dad's chronic illness.
Yeah.
And so many Americans have chronic disease towards end of life and live many years with these chronic and often debilitating diseases. I like to think there's a paradigm shift, and that, you know, us, our age group and younger people, I like to think are talking and thinking about health and wellness and, you know, wellness, right? Living a different lifestyle. I don't know if it's true, but I like to think it is.
And just the, you know, our parents, it's not that they didn't care about living a healthy lifestyle, but they were told things were healthy. The processed foods were healthy. They were the most convenient thing ever. And
these
medications that came, you know, they didn't used to have access to. So this is wonderful for healthcare.
And it's only in
hindsight that we can see the shit show, the chemical shit show that our food processing has been, and some medications.
Well, speaking of the chemical shit show, have you seen medicine keep somebody alive maybe too long?
Oh gosh. I mean, working in geriatrics, I have seen many, many things. You know, even I had a 92-year-old resident who had colon cancer, and her family convinced her to have a colostomy bag. She didn't want that. She wanted to just, you know, live comfortably, but she, you know, and again, it goes back to the family not being able to say, okay.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely. We, again, in this culture, often do too much.
I'm facing that with my dogs. And I know it's not the same, but they're both senior dogs.
That's why pets are a great training for how we treat each other as humans. Well,
and we love them like family.
Of course you do.
And you don't want them to suffer.
Chloe has congestive heart failure, and she, so she was diagnosed in January of 22. And my vet, who I love, said, you know, she probably has 6 months or so. And here we are a year and a half later, more than a year and a half later, none of her medications have stopped or have changed. And, you know, but she's definitely losing muscle mass. And that's more indicative of age. She's going to be 13 pretty soon. But she still enjoys the things that she enjoys. Like, I had a talk with him a couple of weeks ago because she had been having accidents in the living room, which was very, very new. And I had a bit of a meltdown because, like, she was having accidents when we were home. And so what's going on, you know? And basically he said, as long as she's enjoying what she's enjoying, the accidents are bothering you more than they bother her. And so, like, you have to balance that out. And I think part of it was something that maybe we had been putting in their food or something, because we'll put some cheese or tuna or something in their food because she's very hard to medicate. And so it might have been, you know, something like that. It's definitely settled down, and I've gotten like puppy pads, and it's not ideal. We have puppy pads in the living room, and she doesn't have accidents that often, but when she does, that's way easier for us to deal with that than cleaning it up off the floor. But it's, you know, one of our dogs, our first dog, our family dog, my mom kept, like, she just couldn't do it. And Sally was so skinny. It was like, it was so past time that I just, and again, this is a pet. I, you know, when people are in high stress situations looking at a family member and medicine is available and this machine is available, it's just like, I can't imagine how difficult that can be, to know when is enough, especially when there's a family, not like a person or two, but like a whole group of people that are under high stress and probably not getting along. You know, sometimes I'm sure you've seen some good family fights.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, that's gotta be tough. And then the patient is laying there, like, sometimes not being of sound mind or even conscious.
Sure.
And this is hard because we're talking about middle age and ourselves right now.
Right.
We are that patient pretty soon. And it bears us thinking now, like, now, Joyce and I don't have kids of our own. We have stepkids and grandkids. So there's family. But I always think of my sisters sometimes, the decisions that we talk about with our parents. I want to say, I can't wait till you're 88 and Zach and Matt and Katie are bullying you and telling you what to do. I mean, we have to acknowledge that our parents were actually human beings who raised us successfully and have thoughts of their own. Not everybody does. There's dementia, there's advanced illness, but that's something to navigate too, right? That letting people make their decision if they're of sound mind to do so.
Yes. And we need to ask questions, right? And not just gloss over. You know, let me back up. I started my career in mental health. And I worked in emergency rooms doing psych evals, and I worked on psychiatric units. I had no intention of working with the elderly. And one of the units I was working on was transitioning to geropsych. And so they started doing all this training, and I thought, oh God, you know, I don't want to do this, but I ended up loving it. And to your point, our older adults, they have so much wisdom and knowledge. If we just, you know, shut up and listen, that we can learn so much from our older adults. And
they stop telling us because I'm guilty of it. We bark back at them, roll our eyes and tell them what an idiot they are about things because life has moved on, mom.
Yes. Yes.
I think it's different when it's not your parent though, right? Like,
that's probably true, right? There's all kinds of emotional baggage associated with parents and very true.
So that start for you in mental health probably makes a big difference in what you do. Just that understanding.
That's probably true. And because of course, older adults have mental health issues. There's a great deal of depression in the older communities that often goes undiagnosed and, you know, ignored, because even in the medical community, we sort of disregard older adults, you know, oh, well, you're 80, that's going to hurt, as opposed to finding out, well, why does it hurt?
Right, or, right.
You know, that there might be a chemical imbalance. Yeah. And we need more nurses and doctors to go into geriatrics. There's really a desperate
need. Yeah. That makes so much sense. On the lines of that it frustrates me when people say like, I can't do yoga because I can't bend over or I'm in too much pain. And it's like, why is that okay? You know, if you're 50 and you're in pain every day, like 50 isn't old.
Right.
And even if you're in pain at 70 or 80, like, do something.
Well, I do think the culture has changed a little from our parents' generation in that we are more comfortable saying to our doctor, this or this. If I do this, what about this? Right. Or I saw this on the internet. I'm sure it annoys them, but I saw this on the internet. What do you think about it? And at least start a conversation. A lot of our parents, you know, it's like the Pope or the King. Like they won't talk to the doctor.
Absolutely. The doctor said I should take this. So that's like, there's no question. Right. You have to take it.
Do you know what
it
is? Do you know why? Do you know that it interacts with anything?
Well, nope.
No, they just said to take it.
But you're right. You know, unfortunately, we do ask questions and ask for alternatives, and because that is really important.
That's a lot, Amber. Like, that's just a lot.
I'm glad that you started at some point talking about neurons and things. Didn't you have some fancy science to share with us?
Well, so in my job, I do what's called continuing education for nurses and social workers. You know, part of staying connected to the community is providing education. So originally, right when I mentioned to Joyce that I would be game to have to do the podcast, what I mentioned was I do a talk on neuroplasticity. And it's probably my favorite talk that I give because it's really empowering that working in mental health, we for decades have known that, you know, as you age, you start to lose some connections. But it's not inevitable because now what we know is that new connections can be made throughout life. They used to think that once you were a kid and your brain grew and changed and then it stopped and then you just had what you had. But now we know that's not true. And even with folks who have like brain injury or stroke, you know, there's opportunity for the brain to grow new connections, to really heal itself. Work around. Yes.
So break down the word neuroplasticity.
Neuro meaning the neural connections and plasticity, meaning the ability to change or to be flexible. So a rigid brain is an unhealthy brain. A brain with dementia, right, we know is full of plaques and tangles, blocking connections. But a flexible brain is a healthy brain where new connections can be made. I'm digressing for a moment, but I do think it's worth noting. I also do a lot of education on dementia because obviously it's so prevalent with our elderly. And a lot of the new research, there are quite a few researchers who are referring to some forms of dementia as type 3 diabetes.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Which is really fascinating as we're talking about, you know, health and wellness and being proactive, whether it's diet and exercise, that there are, you know, it's right. We have genetics, but there's also epigenetics, right? Where, like you said, the gun is loaded, but what we do determines whether or not we pull the trigger.
Well, I know we mentioned smoking. What are some of your
like big no's or big yeses as far as like keeping your body and your brain, going in the right direction.
So I feel like when I do the talk on neuroplasticity, you know, I'm talking to nurses and social workers, and I feel like when I say this, everyone kind of goes, ugh. But one of the biggest, most powerful things you can do for your brain health is meditation.
Yes.
Just sit quietly. It really is, between exercise and meditation, that is like a bubble bath for your brain. Because we are just we have constant stimulation, constant information coming at us. We're addicted to our phones. You know, the news is 24 hours a day. Our work is 24 hours a day. It's really too much. So if you want your brain to create new pathways, you have to stop. You have to just, you have to meditate. You have to sit quietly. It can be a guided meditation. It can be silent. And honestly, 10 minutes a day will be enough to put you on the right path. You don't have to meditate for an hour a day, but you do have to sit quietly and let your brain rest.
So you have a meditation practice then?
I do.
And how long have you been meditating?
Probably only a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, sometimes it's only 8 minutes a day. Sometimes I don't even reach 10 minutes. But yeah. And like I said, nurses and social workers don't want to hear that. They don't have 10 minutes a day, but it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah. Oh, that's so awesome to hear that. The bubble bath for your brain.
I love that.
I've already stolen.
I am so fortunate because I don't work a normal morning job. And so just this year, I started letting myself wake up, period. And the phone doesn't get grabbed and the TV doesn't get turned on. And I just lay there and wake up like when you're a kid and it's not school time. Oh, you nice. Just wake up and wake up slowly. And my windows are usually open. So there's the birds and there's the breeze. And I know that's most people can't do that. They have to be somewhere at 6 or 7 or 8, but that's my version of it. Cause I'm not a great meditator on purpose either, but so is, you know, a walk.
Absolutely. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a traditional sit, you know, cross your legs and sit. But I think just the act of disconnecting and being present in the moment, like you said, listening to the birds and being here now. We live in the future. What's next? Planning, organizing, you know, that level of anxiety that we all feel just because of the way the culture that we live in. Mm-hmm. And we have to be proactive to disconnect from that.
And it's funny, we do it with food, like the buzzword now with intermittent fasting, that after so many hours, your cells start to sort of eat themselves, like fix the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what meditation can be for your brain, is just fasting from everything, from deliberate thinking for a while.
That is a great way to look at it, that you're letting your brain...
Is that autophagy that they talk about with intermittent fasting? Is that being talked about with brain health as well?
That's interesting. Not yet, but I feel like that probably is coming. Although, you know, to your point, some of the researchers who are talking about dementia as a type 3 diabetes will say, you know, if they had a loved one who was having cognitive issues, the first thing they would do is to tell them to fast or to go on low carb diet. Would be the first thing that they would do. Now, there isn't science yet to prove that, right. But they're researching it. So I think the answer will be eventually yes, that will be a big part of it. And, you know, it's fascinating. So working in dementia care, almost every, you know, 90% of the dementia folks I've worked with, they crave sweets. They cannot get enough ice cream and cookies. And, so it's interesting because it certainly speaks to, being a sugar burner, right?
That
they really need that fix.
Sugar's probably not the best answer all the time though, right?
No. Although I think at some point,
right. By that point, okay. My dad, you know, part of the dementia is, you know, the wandering and the, you know, sometimes it's like, here's a cookie, Hap, let's go this way. So it works. And eating is a problem. I used to laugh when my dad was still in nursing homes. And I know I've probably said this before, and I know it's probably a cost issue, but to give these old people spaghetti noodles, can we just use some rigatoni that they can stab on a fork? So you've got all these people physically and mentally disabled trying to do spaghetti, which is hilarious. And who does the laundry? A lot of bleach.
Well, and the diet, right, that we feed folks in communities like that, it's because, and it is a cost, because that is cheap and easy. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Amber's like,
we brought a lot.
This is another podcast.
Yeah,
it is. Right. We did, though, you know, it's where it becomes difficult to see people without a lot of family visits, because we did bring food all the time. I'm lucky. My sisters and I and our husbands and everybody, we all lived local. So we were there constantly, which changes also your level of care, unfortunately.
Definitely. And, you know, that's part of health and longevity too, is those connections, right? Having people that you love and care about. That's a huge piece of health and wellness, as we know.
I can't even imagine what 2020 was like in your industry with people not being able to visit their loved ones. And
my dad was gone by then. And I remember thinking, I don't know how we would have survived. Knowing your loved one who's already confused, you cannot visit them. I feel like I might've gotten some scrubs and snuck in and been arrested. I really do. I don't know how people manage this, at the stress of it, the guilt of it.
I don't even know how to put it into words. I had left the assisted living for my new job about 6 months before COVID hit. And then when COVID hit, the assisted living that I had previously worked at got hit pretty hard. So I ended up going back there to work in, you know, 10 different capacities, really whatever they needed. Yeah. Right. And much of what I did was calling families to update them and let them know how things were going, and it, which meant a lot to them, because it was, they knew me, they knew, you know, but yeah, it was because, as you know, at the beginning, we didn't know how lethal it was or how it was spread. You know, so I would come home and strip naked in my garage and then go take a shower.
God bless you for doing that with a child at home. Seriously, because it was so important, like a lifeline to those people. I mean, Joyce, imagine you and I couldn't have seen our dads. And there's no way in my dad's case to explain that.
Oh, right. Yes.
Well, I know my dad went into the hospital the first time in July of 2020.
That was COVID time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And he was at Marymount, and he could only have one visitor the whole time, and that was obviously my mom. And then he went back to Marymount at the beginning of August, and just two not great experiences. The second one was really not good. But then when he needed to go back to the hospital, my sister-in-law works for UH, and she had convinced my mom to just take him to UH. And UH was, he could have one visitor a day, but it didn't have to be the same person. We didn't know he was going to be there as long as he was. But it was nice because every once in a while I got to go visit, or my brother got to go visit, and my mom needed a break. She probably wouldn't have said it that way, because, you know, she would never describe it as a burden to go see my dad, but she needed a break too. But it did give us an opportunity to be there. So that was really nice. But then he went to a rehab, and that was a huge nightmare. But when he first got there, they put him on the first floor so we could see him at the window, which was, that was really hard for him, because like he said, he felt like a prisoner, like he's visiting his family at the window, and you can't, you know, you couldn't really, you had to take his word for the most part on like what he was eating and how PT was, because you couldn't be there.
There's
for
another
anything.
Layer of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know what's
and
going on.
Then he had to go to UH for what is it? An endoscopy, when they put the thing down your throat, like the heat.
Yeah.
So
endoscopy.
When he came back, and that was only, he was gone for, I don't even know if he was gone for a whole day, but he had to quarantine again. So they at some point decided to put all the new quarantine people on the third floor. And so then you could, you know, we couldn't see him at the window, and that made it even worse. And they had an iPad up there and apparently told all the residents or all the patients that they could FaceTime or use the iPad as they wish. My dad didn't give a shit about an iPad, you know? Right. And so like, it was just, and then he ended up going back to UH, and we were back to like being able to switch up who was seeing him. And then his end of life, when they knew he was dying, we were all able to be with him. So, but I think later in October, there was a huge surge in COVID, and I don't think that, I think maybe it could have just been my mom. Like, it had it been 2 or 3 weeks later, it would have been a different story. And it's just, I can't, that's just, it was so, that year was so hard.
I can't imagine the people to whom you are so important, because you were that last link. Like, I can't imagine thinking about it. You know, if it were me, and I would want you, please, can you say this to my dad? And I mean, it had to be a lot for you to carry. On top of worrying about bringing this virus home to your family.
It definitely was a lot. Yeah.
How? Go ahead, Amber. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No, I was just going to say it was a very, very scary time, literally for everyone, right? Everyone around the world.
Yeah. In different ways too. Yeah. I mean, really, thank God for people who went in and did stuff.
And I will, it was very meaningful, you know, for me, having known those residents, you know, to go back, to have them have a familiar face. You know, one of the things we did was, of course, we were all covered in head to toe PPE, glasses, mask, the gown. So we printed these huge name badges that had our picture on it.
Oh,
so we could
idea.
Go into a person's room and say, you know, hi, it's me, Amber, and point to the badge. Yeah. Because, you know,
I mean, some
only...
of these confused people probably thought they were ending their life on another planet.
Right. It was, yeah, it was hard. It was hard times, no doubt, for literally
thank
everyone.
You. I'm just saying thank you on behalf of, I'm sure you've been thanked a gazillion times, but thank you.
I appreciate that.
How do you think your career has had an effect on your daughter?
Oh, that's a great question.
Other than she had to see you naked in the garage.
Yeah. Right. Other than me sprinting through the house.
Which will scar her forever.
Right. Okay. Actually, I think it's very significant. So when I was running the assisted living and Ingrid was quite young, I would bring her in. So for example, I like to go in on Thanksgiving morning and just pour coffee at breakfast and say, happy Thanksgiving to the residents. Because if they were still in the building, that meant that they probably weren't going to family. They were there for the day. So I would bring Ingrid with me and she would help me pour coffee.
But they loved that.
Oh, they absolutely loved it. You know, or if we had, of course, a family event, I would have her there. And even now, she is an official Cypress Hospice volunteer. She's gone through the volunteer program, and she helps us to stock shelves with medical equipment. But I mean, it's pretty, in my opinion, pretty huge that she has been exposed to older adults. She doesn't feel uncomfortable around the elderly. I think she's pretty confident, you know, from doing things like even just stocking shelves, right?
Yeah.
And being exposed to healthcare and the elderly. I recently did a craft at an assisted living and I made Ingrid come with me and help. And of course the residents love that, right? They're thrilled to see a young
person. Oh gosh,
person.
It probably makes their day. They're tired of the same old day in, day out spaghetti and the same aides that they see and the same schedule.
Yeah.
And to expose her not only to all that you just said and just speaking with old people, which is hard for kids, mm-hmm. but the responsibility of service to others yes. is not passed on to every child in America. Let's just say.
Yes. Yeah. So I think it's huge.
And it gives her, it's going to give her life and career more meaning mm-hmm. than a person who's groomed to get a career and not have that angle of service to others as part of their vernacular.
Yes, I hope so.
Does Ingrid have all of her grandparents?
No, her two, she has two grandmas and one grandpa. But she did lose a step grandfather. And then my dad actually died before she was born.
Oh.
But she does have excellent relationships with her grandmas. You know, she texts them, they FaceTime. Yeah, she does have really good relationships with them.
For, you know, Joyce and I find ourselves a little bit young-ish to be grandmas, I guess. I mean, not really, yeah. but, you know, it's nice to hear that because right now we're the fun grandmas. We're young. I mean, they're going to get a life, Joyce, away from us. And we're going to have to hope that we have those good relationships too. We have to keep up on technology is the ticket.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, we're going to be.
I won't stay texting and FaceTime because God knows what it's going to be 20 years from now.
Mary Beth will be those grandmas that are like, just use FaceTime. What's the
problem? Use the face.
You may or may not have listened to the podcast, but my dad had five brothers and my Uncle John died a couple months ago and four out of the six brothers died at 76 within like days of each other,
yeah.
Including my dad. So it hit me when I was talking to somebody about my uncle's passing, that I'm 50 and 76 is, you know, as we get older, time just seems to fly even faster.
Oh, it really does. It really does. Like,
yeah. 26 years.
Think of two decades flying past like nothing.
Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, 25, 26, 24, whatever, doesn't feel that far away. I remember every, maybe not every bit of it, but like, and so my granddaughter is about to be 3 and in, you know, 26 years, she'll just be 29. And I'll be 76. And it's
29.
Like,
you know, will she be married or, you know?
Will she live in the same area? Well, like there's just.
Ashley, James and Joyce's daughter, Ashley, just had a birthday. And I saw James on Ashley's birthday between classes. And I said, you know, it just seems like yesterday she was in high school and here working the desk. She babysat my granddaughter for a family wedding or two that we had. So it was like, how is Ashley this old and with a child this old?
Yeah, it is crazy.
Yeah. And things change, but like that, it's just, as you said this before, Amber, like we don't have much time here at all.
We really don't.
And yeah, sometimes,
y'all are bringing on my depression.
Sorry, Mary Beth.
As I drove to classes yesterday, you know, I'm lucky that I can enjoy more summer than, say, the back to school gang. But I think I saw a red leaf yesterday, and I was like, "No."
It is. The evenings are starting to cool down, kind of like fall. But I think that's a bit temporary. Maybe.
Yeah. Next week's going to be hot again. Said you know who.
Oh.
Well, Mary, let me tell you, one of the talks that I do is on the science of happiness.
Ooh.
And so, you know, my research or, you know, my education was focused on mental health. And when you talk about mental health, you talk about abnormality, right? So that was my training, like what goes wrong. But there is a new science on wellness. You know, what does it mean to be mentally well? What does it mean to be happy? So what I want to say is that research tells us that 40% of your overall happiness, wellness, is within your control. That, you know, there's a chunk that is environment and there's a piece that's genetics, but 40% is really your attitude and your perspective. And I want to say that because I feel like that's significant, right?
Significant. If we're only here, there's choices to be made.
Yes. And if we know we're here for a short time, why would we make any other choice but to be happy?
Right. And the older we get, it is a choice. Like there's self-talk involved. Like I wake up feeling a certain way and maybe I have to talk myself into turning that around a bit. Do you have you written like an article or something about the science of happiness that you can share?
So what I do is for continuing education, you have to attend like hour long presentations. So I have presentations on the science of happiness, resilience, neuroplasticity, stress, things like that.
My dad's, for any who haven't heard this ad nauseum already, my dad's given name was Gerald, but he went through life as Hap. Because he was happy. So hopefully I'm genetically predisposed to happiness. And then if I can help out with the other 40%.
Do you get that golden a lot with your patients where, cause I feel like that's a generational thing too. Like his name was Gerald, but they call him Hap. My uncle Jerry, it was actually named Richard.
Oh, how funny. There's just little nicknames, huh?
Yeah. And it's funny that they stick, right? Even beyond school or
My grandmother named my dad Gerald Harrell, which kind of rhymes, which is insane. He was actually supposed to be named Calvin after his father, but she too was very Catholic and Calvin was a no bueno name. So she named him after her two brothers, Jerry and Tony, Gerald Anthony. But quickly he became Hap. Like Hap. The number of people who called him Jerry or Gerald. In fact, when he was in nursing care, I would always make a big sign saying, call me Hap, because people see his chart and they're like, hi, Gerald. And I'm like, he about to kick you. he's got the dementia, but he knows his name and it ain't Gerald.
So let me ask you, did his happy personality stick with him through end of life?
No, he had Lewy body dementia, which, as you might know, involves a lot of delusions and hallucinations. And unfortunately, he was pretty young. He was in his early 70s, very physically healthy and strong. And his delusions would include things like someone raping our mother.
Oh, no.
Or trying to kill one of us kids. And so he was just always,
oh my gosh,
tortured and on the move. We were in 5 different nursing homes. Because he was hard to control. He was young and muscular and athletic and strong, and he was gone. He was like, get off, get out of my office. You're stealing my files. And we'd get the call. Meet us at the Jerry Psych Ward at X Hospital, whoever had a bed that night.
Yeah.
Which that process, just to divert the conversation a little, that process kind of sucks too, because when your loved one with dementia has an episode, and that can be brought on even just by like a urinary tract infection or something, because they can't say how they feel and it just affects how they act. They get ambulanced to the emergency room, like everybody else, like the kid that fell out of a tree and broke his arm. So there you have a person with dementia. Like I remember one night, my sister Colleen in the ER with my dad, who was wearing a bright blue cardigan that he had lifted off of a nurse's station. And like a gown, because I don't even know what went on, but they have to sit through this normal ER triage, blood tests, et cetera, before, I wish there was a fast track from nursing homes into geriatrics, even a geriatric ER. I know it's impossible to staff stuff like that, but.
Yeah. Our medical system is not great. That's a different podcast, but
right.
Well, and we're touching on mental health a lot in this, but mental health isn't part of physical health treatment. And I believe that it should be. I mean, when James hurt his shoulder and he was in the hospital for a couple of days, like I asked for if mental health treatment was available. It was a very high stress time. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we can give you a referral for, you know, later. And
I'm thanks. I can Google that.
Yeah. But later it's either going to be worse or, like it's not going to be top of mind, you know, but
yeah, more holistic, I think is what you're saying. Like we need a holistic approach.
Yes.
Yes. Our medical system is definitely in silos, right? You get treated for one thing by one person and then you got to go somewhere else for something else. We rarely look at the whole picture.
I always think of that with people who have had a heart attack. You have to have less stress. You have to relax. Well, that's going to give somebody a heart attack. If they're used to not, if they're used to doing, and now you say you cannot get out of this bed and you cannot look at your phone, they're going to, ooh.
Yes.
Well, there's there's just too much medication. There's something, a pill to fix everything. I know a lot of my dad's issues were, well, you know, he'd go to the doctor, end up in the emergency room. And it was just an adjustment in the medication because they put him on something new for his kidneys and that messed with his heart medication. And it just, he needed a little tune up, you know.
And the idea of, is there anybody driving the bus? Because your arthritis doctor gave you something that your heart doctor would say, no bueno. And, you know, we used to have better sort of personal relationships, even with pharmacists that would help with that. And yes, the computers help, like this drug interacts with this one, but still a lot slips through.
Definitely. Do you see that a lot, Amber?
Absolutely. And, you know, now we have hospitalists. So there's when you go to the hospital, you have a doctor there, but it's not your primary care doctor and it's not your rheumatologist. So yeah, it's very complicated. And in fact, one of the first things that hospice services does is a medication reconciliation, where you go through the 3-page med list and probably discontinue half of it. to say, okay, what are we really doing here?
I wouldn't be surprised if you see a big improvement.
We often do. Yeah. That, you know, especially, you know, that's the other piece of it, is that there are not enough geriatric specialists. And so doctors are treating the elderly like they would treat you and me, and their metabolisms are different. Their bodies are different. They can't handle the same medications, but they end up on them. That's again, a whole other.
Yeah. So
I'm sure you have, on a lighter side, I'm sure you have some funny story, like you see some funny things and you have to just laugh at some point.
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, I'll tell you when I started my career in mental health, for extra money, I would escort non-voluntary patients to court.
Wow. So
if you have a mental health crisis and you end up in an emergency room, you can say, yes, I want treatment, and sign yourself in, or a doctor and a social worker can involuntarily petition you and say, you can't go home, you're going to the hospital. And then you can choose to either stay and sign the paperwork, or you can say, no, I'd like to go in front of a judge. So again, for extra money, I would escort these patients to the court. Which you'd think we would have transportation, but instead I would get in a taxi with people and hope for the best.
Oh my God.
Holy moly.
Yeah. It was so fascinating. So they would go in front of the judge, and, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, the judge would agree with the social worker and the doctor, and the person would come back with me and they'd have to undergo treatment. But once in a while, someone would convince the judge. Like one time I had a woman who convinced the judge that she just had really bad PMS, and that's why she was acting crazy.
And so I'll be fine till next month, Your Honor.
Right. And the judge said, okay, fair enough. And so she got into a different taxi and went home from the court. So yes, wow. I have all kinds of stories.
What, without going too far down a rabbit hole. So you're a young person. What takes you into this path?
Oh, you know, so when I was in undergrad, I went to a college because I thought I was going to be a teacher. And then at some point I was sitting in a poetry class and I had just turned in, you know, my classes for the next semester. And I thought, oh my God, I don't want to be alone in a room with a bunch of kids for the rest of my life. Like, what am I doing? And so I left that poetry class and I ran to the registrar's office and I begged them to give me my form back, which they were not supposed to do, but I think I started to cry. And so she gave it to me.
whatever works.
And I just started taking sociology and psychology classes. And I ended up with a double major in those two topics, because to me, that was fascinating. I love thinking about how the brain works and how people interact with one another. And I mean, that's just inspiring to me. So then as I finished with that degree, you know, I realized that I had no idea what I was going to do do with my life.
I'm just going to go around learning and talking.
Right. That would be great. But anyway, so that's what led me to social work. So I am a licensed counselor. I don't work in that capacity. But that's sort of my my early retirement plan would be to eventually go back into outpatient practice one-on-one.
Wow. Excellent.
I have to ask you, you must not be afraid of aging and death.
I am afraid of aging. I want to age well.
Okay. Yeah. Afraid maybe isn't the right word.
Yes. I'm afraid of having chronic disease. I'm afraid of spending the last 10 years of my life in a nursing home. That scares me. I really do focus a lot on health and wellness because I want to live as energetically as I can and then drop dead.
Yeah.
Right. Isn't that everybody?
If only we could all like just go to sleep one night and not wake up the next at a ripe old age.
Yes.
Right.
So I think I'm probably more cognizant of death than most
I would say
people.
So. Yeah.
I'm not afraid of what's next. What about you ladies?
I want to say that I'm not afraid, but I also, I had this conversation, kind of wasn't a deep one, but it was with my mom. We were, driving through her apartment complex, which is 55 plus, and I would guess most of them are more like 70 plus. Very beautiful apartment complex. It's Traditions on the corner of York and 82, and they have a pool. And I think it was Memorial Day weekend, and James and I took her. We went out to eat, and so she was in my car, and you know, we were passing the pool. I'm like, "Mom, you should really use the pool more often because it's why not, right?" And she goes, "Those people are so old," and I just don't feel like I belong with like those aren't my. She wasn't saying it this way, but you know, those aren't her peers kind of thing. Like, yeah. I don't feel that old. And she's like, "Do I look that old?" And I just like I had like a moment, a personal moment that I'll get to in a second, but I was like, "Mom, so you're 76, like regardless."
Judy, you don't look 76.
No, she doesn't look 76, but like, it doesn't change the fact that you're 76. And I have that, like, I get this all the time. I don't look 50 and like, you know, I can't believe you're a grandma, that kind of thing. And I feel great. I guess I'm aging well, but I'm 50.
You're aware of. Yeah.
And so, like I said, you know, a moment ago, like 26 years, isn't that far away. And so I don't know that I'm afraid of death, but I don't think I'm ready to process something that's much closer than I
far away,
because I feel so good. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I have so much more left to do or accomplish or share on this planet that 26 years, not that I'm, that I have, you know, that's going to happen in 26 years, but who knows, right? Like, who knows? So I guess, yeah, that's what I'm struggling with. If it's a struggle, it's not a struggle because I haven't been thinking about it. But like,
it actually is a struggle for me.
Is it?
You're
you guys both. I don't know how old you are, Amber, but like, the three of us are very. And of course, as you get older, like 60 doesn't seem old to us, right?
Oh,
like,
right.
That's really young. Right. Right? Right. Like when you were 20, thinking about your 50-year-old self, is this what you imagined?
Oh no, my gosh. I thought that I was going to be a lot older when I was
right. Getting your hair done once a week or whatever. Yeah. I am not afraid of death and what's after it. I am afraid of suffering.
Yes.
I've had a very happy, very easy, very blessed life. I haven't been sick or abandoned or abused. I have it easy. I love it. And so I don't want to leave it. Even if I believe what's after it is better, it's just human to not want to let go of this. And so, and I've always been introspective that way, where I do worry about things that haven't happened yet. I mean, I was the kid, I would check my parents to see if they were breathing as a kid. So I've, for whatever reason, always been a little too obsessed with losing this wonderful life. And so, yeah, pretty much every day I have to think about this. Perhaps I should have consulted somebody about this long ago.
But the beauty of that then is that, you know, there's a Buddhist saying about live life as if death is whispering in your ear, right? And you're functionally doing that you realize it could end. And so hopefully that means you live each day to the fullest and you are grateful, right? Grateful to be alive.
Yes, that I am.
But what that prevents, I think, maybe not in the Buddhist saying, is like us getting our shit together because we're going to die. Right. Like getting all the stuff in order.
You think with this voice in my ear all these years, I might have my shit together, but no, not a bit. Right.
Yes. You notice she's changed hairstyles about 5 times during our conversation.
Hot, cold.
And they all look good. Cold. Yeah.
They do all look good.
Thank you. My brother-in-law, Brian, saw my car the other day, just another diversion here. And he called me a couple days later and he said, "Can I have your car on Sunday?" And I said, "What do you need my car for? Because I have an old car." He goes, "I'm going to detail it." He goes, "I'm good at that. And it sounds like you need it." So I'm like, well, I'm going to have to get it ready to be detailed because I got a lot to get out
of. Is he going
to
organize all your stuff? Is that what he said?
Well, no, I'm going to have to take my stuff out, but he will clean it because I also am the person that has my sunroof and windows open all summer. So it's freaking gross in there. There's dust all over everything. Yeah. And there's a lot of eating and changing clothes and stuff that goes on in there.
This is, she's bringing a lot of baggage. This is an analogy to her end of life. She's just... Right.
Thank you for making the connection, because that's what it is. It's like, if something does happen, oh my gosh, he's going to take care of all this stuff that I've not taken care of.
It's just stuff, though.
Just stuff. Exactly.
Yeah. If somebody could drop a grenade in it and let it go, I just don't want it to be a problem for someone to deal with.
Well, Amber, thank you so much for one.
This has been so interesting.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. For one, asking to be on the podcast, and two, being patient with us getting you scheduled. I know we had a couple of hiccups along the way, and we would love to have you back, because that's going to be Mary Beth's project in a while. We're going to having all of our guests.
We're going to have a season of all second visits, because we always have to cut it shorter than we want, and we always want to check back in. And now we have a long list of people to say that about. So.
And once we absorb and like really process all of this, we're going to have more questions. But I really appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Thanks for being such a great yoga practitioner and customer and supporting us. I really, really appreciate that. It's been nice to get to know you over the years. And I really appreciate your help and advice when my dad was going through what he was going through. And I'm sure you have been such an integral part to this stressful and beautiful time in a lot of people's lives. And I hope you get thanked enough.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. It was nice to get to know both of you, and thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate you. And just one more yoga nod connection there is, you know, the modern yoga community that involves all these kind of conversations is so helpful. You've already talked, Joyce, about how you connected with Amber when it was your dad's turn. And we've done that with everything from your profession to physical therapists to dog watching, dog sitting. So thank you too, Joyce, for creating a community where we can all share like what Amber was talking about, the connection and how relationships and people's minds work. Does anybody need to thank me for anything?
Thank you for your hair.
So welcome. All right, we're done.
It was nice. Thank you so much, ladies. What a blast.